Dr. Joe Nickel, can you give us a bit of a backgrounder on the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal?
I like to point out that investigation is our middle name. We look into paranormal claims and fringe science claims. By paranormal, we mean those things that are beyond the normal range of science and human experience. It's a broad umbrella that would include all of the supernatural, but also include such things as UFOs or the Loch Ness Monster, which, if they existed, might be perfectly natural. My own personal philosophy is that we should neither be close-minded debunkers nor credulous mystery mongers. We should carefully investigate paranormal claims with a view toward solving.
Strange days indeed on News Talk 1010 CFRB in Toronto and Montreal's News Talk leader CJAD 800.
Program 241 of these strange days indeed. Welcome to our listeners in Montreal, those of you listening around the world on the World Wide Web, and to our legion of listener here in Toronto at News Talk 1010 CFRB. Good to have you all along. The voice there of, I guess, one of the people that a lot of ufologists are not totally thrilled with, Joe Nickel of the Committee for the Scientific Supposedly Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, and investigation is their middle name. Yeah. Well, as time goes by on this program over the coming months, if you've not heard of them before, you'll hear about them again. And the high esteem that a lot of UFO researchers hold that organization in. You know, it occurred to me earlier today, as I was putting this introduction together, that ufology has more friends in the halls of academia than it does sometimes seem to be aware of. And a splendid example is our feature guest tonight, Dr. Don Dondary, who's Associate Professor of Psychology at McGill University in Montreal. Now, his credentials include Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Science degrees from the University of Chicago in the late 50s, and a PhD in Experimental Psychology from Cornell University in 1963. Dr. Dondary has over 40 years' experience in human factors, ergonomics, and applied experimental psychology. He's the co-author of a psychology textbook, many research papers and technical reports on human perception, motivation, memory, and thinking. And Dr. Dondary has also written many articles for UFO-related publications and contributed a chapter titled Science, Law, and War, Alternative Frameworks for the UFO Evidence in UFOs and Abductions, Challenging the Borders of Knowledge, an academically based book edited by Dr. David Jacobs and published by Kansas University Press. Joining us on the phone from his home in Montreal is Dr. Don Dondary. Good evening, sir, and welcome to this program.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
And we're glad to have you here. My mind actually boggles a little bit when I think of a man with all of your credentials who has quite openly said, this subject, unidentified flying objects, is fascinating to me. And the amount of time and the amount of energy and the amount of work that you've put into this field, aside from all of the other work that you do, what intrigued you with all of this?
Well, I'm a curious person, curious about the way things are. And I've been curious about the way things are for a long time. This goes back during my undergraduate years when I first heard about UFO sightings on the radio, literally. And I think my interest was really piqued by the big controversy that happened in 1966 when Alan Hynek, who was a UFO investigator, as you, I'm sure, everybody knows on your program, for Project Blue Book, investigated some cases in Michigan and mentioned quite inadvertently that he thought some of them were caused by methane gas, the famous swamp gas explanation. This basically produced a public outcry, as everybody knows, in the UFO community. And I had been interested in a long time. At that point, I realized that this was, that he obviously had made an embarrassing mistake. He took it a lot more seriously than that comment suggested. And I figured at that point I'd find out a little more about things myself, so I joined NICAP, the original National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was active during the 60s, and began to get involved, literally, in something that matched my professional qualifications, because I'm a researcher in perception and memory.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are obviously phenomena that people see and then remember and tell you about.
Now, Richard Hole, who's a regular contributor to this program, wrote last year in a post to UFO Updates, the email list that I moderate, and I quote Richard. He says, in his chapter of the University of Kansas press book, UFOs and Abductions, edited by David Jacobs, Don Dundary argues that the scientific establishment is not well-equipped to deal with the UFO subject, and nor is it the only method of procedure used in our society to establish truth. In the past, we have spent a lot of time scratching our heads on this program, wondering why it is that science appears not to be interested in this phenomenon at all.
It's a very interesting and, I think, fairly clear answer to this. Scientists are people who are, these days, not in the past, but currently, I'd say the last 50 years, are people driven by theoretical interests and by what Thomas Kuhn, who wrote about the philosophy of science and the practice of science, called paradigms. That is, little pictures of the way the universe should work that they try to fill out. And in Kuhn's word, they are trying to solve very complicated crossword puzzles where they know the techniques, they have the dictionary, and basically all it takes is a lot of application, specialized skills, and hard work to get to where you're going, whether you're trying to sequence the human genome or find out more about learning in subhuman primates or something of this sort. There's a specialty, there are techniques, you can publish for your colleagues, and if anything comes up that's outside your own area, it's not grist for your mill, simply, because it doesn't fit what you're doing and it doesn't fit the limits of your vision as a scientist. And almost every scientist has a very limited vision of what his or her work is. Let me cite you something that David Jacobs quoted from Albert Einstein years ago. Einstein said, apropos of UFOs, these people have seen something. I'm paraphrasing, but I've got it almost right. These people have seen something. What it is, I do not know and do not care, or do not want to know. In other words, Einstein, probably the greatest scientist of the 20th century, one of those imaginative scientists of the 20th century who contributed all sorts of new ideas to physics, had no interest in this phenomenon, which he didn't deny was a phenomenon. And scientists are like that. They work in paradigms, they work in their area of interest. If it isn't something they can use to explain or elaborate a new theory, or if it isn't something that changes a present theory into one that is better in their field, it's just, in Kuhn's words, it's not evidence. It's not something a scientist has any business, as a scientist, paying any attention to. So scientists are perfectly qualified to dismiss and ignore everything that's outside of their, and I say this with respect, narrow technical field of interest. There are very few scientists whose business, like mine, is to study human perception and memory, who would even take a semi-professional interest in this field because it just doesn't fit into what they're having to do. And what you have on your program, and I'm delighted to hear it because I was listening to it earlier,
mm-hmm.
is people who are not professional scientists, who spend a lot of time and energy, more than I do, by the way, far more than I do, gathering up information that is interesting about UFOs and collecting it. Now, that's what scientists used to do in the 19th century. They were famous scientists who were collectors. They were collecting rocks. They were collecting animals. They were collecting flowers. They went around the world and did this. And
there
this was
an enormous curiosity back in those
years. That's right.
Years.
That's right. And being a good scientist in those days meant collecting things, collecting information, finding out about nature. Now, this is a new kind of information we're collecting, but scientists aren't collecting it anymore, with few exceptions. You started out by saying perhaps there are more people in academia than you might think who are interested in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a list here. Many of them were people who were writing in this book, but there are at least a dozen people with academic positions who write quite openly on UFO questions. All of them but a few are what you might call interested protagonists. One or two are skeptics mm-hmm. or have alternative theories, but they're all respectable people engaging in serious discourse about this topic. And you're right, there are some, some but not that many in academia.
What's interesting is that one of the people that wrote a chapter in the book is Dr. Michael Persinger of Laurentian University up there in Sudbury.
That's right.
How does he get to spend time trying to explain the UFO phenomena?
Well, his research line, if you want to put it that way, because all of us have lines or specialties, has to do with studying the effect on the brain of external magnetic fields, rapidly changing magnetic fields. Now, that's of some interest to people for other reasons other than just interest in UFOs.
Hmm.
And his theory, which is that what you might call little sub-epileptic seizures might produce the phenomena that people associate with UFOs is a theory. It's a plausible theory. I don't believe it explains most of the cases, but it might explain some of them. And he does that kind of stuff, and he publishes widely on it. He's highly respected and highly productive. But it's an interest that, sort of like mine, intersects the field and gives him an opportunity to do work that is at least tangentially related to the UFO field without violating the terms of his research grants or whatever. So that's a possibility. And other people who are in the field either have university positions in which they're secure, and by that I mean they have tenure, and they have interests that are wide enough to encompass this, and their colleagues don't mind. My colleagues don't mind at all.
And certainly Dr. John Mack and Dr. David Jacobs both have had huge interest in abductions.
Yes, well, I have to say, John Mack's colleagues did object at one point.
Well, yes, they
practically
did.
Practically got him fired. But
there were one or two who objected, and fortunately for he and the people that he's been working with over the years, Harvard was loudly booed down by jurisprudence.
That's right, and and that's great. I'm delighted. I helped because just about everybody who knew him wrote letters in his favor and stuff like that. So
basically what you're saying is that science is not ever going to look at UFOs?
What I said in this article, and Hulk paraphrased it very nicely, is that ordinary conventional science has no place, and this is, I'm paraphrasing now, this famous philosopher of science who died a couple of years ago named Thomas Kuhn, who said, and I quoted him in this article, that if there's some counter-theoretical observation or phenomenon that comes to the attention of a scientist, unless the scientist can use that observation to expand or change an existing theory or fit it into a new theory that encompasses a lot of information, then the only thing he can do, and now I'm really saying what Kuhn said, is he either ignores it, or if it's so upsetting to him, he has to get out of science and do something else, like go wash cars for a living. I'm perfectly serious. That's what he said. He didn't say wash cars, but he did say,
yes.
And I'm paraphrasing again, the only option for a scientist who isn't willing to accept that he has to ignore this data is to get out of science. And that's conventional science for you.
There seems to be more of a search for truth, as you say in your chapter in the book, used by the legal system and military intelligence.
That's right. I say both of those professions would or have dealt better with this information than the academia.
The methods used by the legal system and by the military intelligence community seem to be a lot more concentrated on the search for the truth than science.
Well, it's concentrated in a different way. I'm not a military intelligence analyst, so I can't, other than through reading, tell you about what they do. There's a marvelous book on the subject by actually a UFO skeptic named R.V. Jones, a very famous British scientist who ran the Air Special Intelligence branch of the MI6 during the Second World War. But that's getting ahead of the story. What I do know more about, because I actually do work in court, is the legal system. And in the case of civil law, where you have to convince a judge, usually, especially in Canada, that the preponderance of evidence is in your favor, and that usually means, in studies of this, about 55% probability, which is better than half, but not 90%, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, that you've got the evidence on your side, I think you could convince a civil court that there's plenty of evidence for the reality of UFOs. And in a court, there's no scientific theory to block paying attention to the evidence, because courts have a somewhat different approach to evidence than scientists do. They're not working on a preconceived theory. The theory of what goes on in a case, a civil case or a criminal case, is what the lawyer uses to explain the facts in front of him. Now, the smoking gun, as you know, that's the famous phrase used in legal cases, the smoking gun could have been fired by the woman standing over the guy with the blood coming out of his chest, or the woman could have picked the gun up off the ground after the actual killer had run away. Those are two different theories about why she was found at the scene with a gun in her hand. And the defense lawyer and the prosecution have to explain to the judge or jury how the facts of the case demonstrate either one of those two theories. But it starts with the facts. And the legal profession works from facts to a theory, and the theory of the case has to be proved from the facts. You don't start with a theory and only pay attention to the facts that either confirm it or disconfirm it. You can actually build your theory on the basis of whatever facts you've collected and can persuade the judge and jury are credible.
Mm-hmm.
So the legal system is more inductive. It takes the evidence for what it is rather than starting with a theory. And that's a more open-minded attitude towards UFO evidence.
And does the military intelligence, in your reading, as an observer rather than an authority, does it function the same way?
It functions, in a way, even better. I won't quote a long passage, but what R.V. Jones says when he's talking about military intelligence is that an intelligence organization bears many resemblances to the human head. They will generally be on the alert, each sense searching for its own signals. For example, as soon as the ears hear a noise, the eyes will turn and look in that direction. The point he was making was that if you get some odd signal that something's happening in another country that you don't know about, the military intelligence analyst has to go look, has to find out what explains this oddness. He can't take for granted that it's something that can be dismissed because our own scientists don't understand it. And when it comes to the UFO phenomena, as reported by all the talented amateurs as well as professionals who've collected this data, it's clear that our science can't explain it. The argument that a scientist makes is that because we can't explain it, we're not interested. It doesn't fit our science, therefore, from our point of view, it doesn't exist. From the military intelligence analyst's point of view, that's extremely dangerous. It's like ignoring the chatter before 9/11, suggesting something was going to happen and thinking that it doesn't matter. It's real evidence that military intelligence analysts pay attention to, and frankly, I expect some of them, or a lot of them, already know that the stuff is not just anomalous perceptions or misperceptions or bad memories or whatever.
I don't think you're alone in that feeling.
There's obviously, in the UFO community, a tremendous amount of controversy about how much the government knows or doesn't know. And I haven't an answer to that because I'm no better informed than the average well-informed reader of what people publish on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But I expect, as basically, since, first of all, the phenomenon is there, and your amateurs can tell us that just as well as I can, and they and others have collected many, many serious multiple witness radar visual accounts, all of the usual things that UFO people talk about over the decades.
Mm-hmm.
If amateurs can do this, the people who have access to military sensors certainly have done it and can do it. And many of the widely known reports are also, of course, from military sources as well. And there's a long list of books that have been written by ex-military people on this, all of which basically make the same case. There's plenty of evidence, and obviously somebody knows what's going on. There's plenty of contrary evidence in sociology, but that's another story altogether.
I have an email here from Wendy Connors, who was on just a little while ago. She says, it's a pleasure to hear you tonight. Have you had a personal experience with UFOs outside of your own research?
That's a very interesting question. I have seen two what you'd call nocturnal lights, or what Alan Hynek called nocturnal lights, which are not what you'd call the highest category of UFO evidence. In other words, if that's all there was to this phenomenon, nobody would take it seriously. But I have seen a couple of nocturnal lights, which I wouldn't make a case on myself. I've done investigations, I've followed up other people's cases, collected witness data, collected photographic data, worked with cases from colleagues at McGill who just don't want to be publicly identified, but who've seen at close range UFOs and have these logged and recorded. So as an investigator, I've collected my share of cases, but as a personal experiencer, I would say my experiences are relatively minimal.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed her fading discs very much, by the way. That was a really neat feature.
Yeah, she has a lot of, literally hundreds of clips that we hope to make our way through it in the next several years.
That's interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. And not only is it the woman in Calgary who had her engine quit because of a UFO, but it's the pilots, you know.
Right.
And all of those clips, when you hear the voices describing their experiences, adds a degree of reality to it that you don't get from reading a book.
That's quite true. And I have had people like pilots talk to me about experiences they wouldn't talk to anybody else about, too, simply because they didn't want to be publicly identified with the phenomenon.
You have also taken a fairly lengthy look at the abduction phenomenon, or perhaps more accurately, what, the false memory side of abductions?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting topic, and a very complicated one, I have to say. In the same article, a chapter I wrote, I did write about that. It's difficult. I know by firsthand experience of one abduction case, and it's obviously well known to the rest of the world because Bud Hopkins wrote about it in his book, Witnessed. It's the famous Linda case. I was present when Linda was interviewed on one occasion, sat through one hypnotic regression session. But the evidence for that case doesn't depend just on hypnotic regression or on what Linda said to Bud Hopkins, whether under hypnosis or not. It's a case with multiple corroborations. And that's the important thing about evidence, whether it's just a UFO sighting or an alleged abduction. There has to be more than somebody's testimony that something happened. There has to be multiple independent corroborating testimony for anyone to take it seriously. And in that case, I take it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hopkins did his homework. He got the independent evidence. It's a very rich and detailed case. And I know it's been attacked violently by people who are against it or who object to it. But in my opinion, it holds up. And that's, if you might want to say, an informed opinion, because I know a fair amount about hypnosis, about psychological processes, and about mental states as well. But I wouldn't say that everybody who speaks about an abduction has had one, because it's easy to be self-confused about that. And there's a very strong counter-argument, which is that not all abduction cases are abductions, of course. Some of them may just be a credulous and upset person being persuaded by a credulous and naive therapist to produce a story that matches what we all know is the abduction scenario. So you have, on the one hand, what appear to be really good cases with corroborating evidence, with multiple witnesses, and on the other hand, you have the very obvious truth that people unwittingly and without intending to deceive can produce experiences, in quotes, that they didn't really experience. One of my colleagues, Beth Loftus, who's a very well-known experimental psychologist and has been involved in the false memory debate, arguing against the fact that many people who've been accused of sexual abuse actually did it, is very clear on that. She's proved that you can implant memories in people and have them regurgitate them afterwards as if they actually produced them, but merely by a long and rather careful process of suggestion. So you have to be extremely careful about abduction cases, and you have to research them very, very thoroughly. Once you have, you've got a case like Bud Hopkins' Linda case, I think you've got evidence that something like that happened.
We had a guest on last week, Stan Romanek, who has had some quite amazing experiences, as well as going through what he thinks is abduction, and has woken up in the morning with all kinds of very strange marks on his body. When the folks at the Mutual UFO Network put his hands under black light, where he had had wounds in his hands that at the time gave him absolutely no pain at all, but under the black light where the scars were, there was fluorescence there, which was inexplicable. He had several sightings that were seen by literally dozens of other witnesses, and a lot of them have written letters to that effect. So you have that case on the one hand, and then you have an example of what you were saying about therapists working with patients and not just inadvertently, but going out of their way to convince them that they'd had interaction with extraterrestrials. And that particular person actually lost his license to practice in California.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure I know that case, but I do know that somebody went to John Mack in Boston with a fabricated UFO story and got him to believe it. So it's not impossible to do.
Yes.
I know that, and you have to be extremely careful.
Mm-hmm. And that was a very tricky one for Dr. John Mack,
yes,
too.
Yes, it was.
Have you worked directly with abductees?
I have not, only as the guest of Bud Hopkins on that one occasion.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an area, again, where I have no firsthand experience, and all of it is academic and scholarly reading plus interpretation.
How do you see those experiences?
This is really complicated, and this is probably the hardest and most controversial issue in the field now. If you start, like a lot of skeptics do, with the idea that they probability of the existence of UFOs is zero, then obviously all of these abduction experiences are in the head, because there's nothing to abduct you. And there's all sorts of other explanations that people have brought up: sadomasochistic fantasies, wishful thinking, suggestion by therapists, something along the sexual abuse line of basically having it suggested to you. All of those are alternative hypotheses. However, if you start with good evidence, and the Hopkins case described in Witness is, I think, the best and most thoroughly documented multiple corroborative witness case to abductions, then you have a phenomenon that suggests, first, there are UFOs, and second, sometimes the people, whoever they are, who operate UFOs, take in humans out of interest, look at them, and put them back again. That, I think, is what the Hopkins case establishes. One of the very controversial issues is, how often does it happen? There was a Roper poll that was done, maybe 10 or 15 years ago now, in which, using a bunch of possible answers to questions, Hopkins and a couple of other people put together the possibility that as many as 1% of the U.S. population had been abducted, which, of course, is multiple millions of people.
It's huge, yes.
That's dubious. I don't think anyone, having looked at that research critically, suggests that that's a figure that could be sustained. However, I am working with Bud Hopkins and Ted Davis to try and refine a better test that will make it possible to narrow down and be more, what you might call, critical about who is and who isn't a potential abductee. But I'd say, in any case, no paper and pencil test is going to settle that issue in any individual case. There has to be additional evidence for you to take the possibility that someone's been abducted seriously. Mm-hmm. And it certainly isn't just on their say-so.
There seems to be a growing body of evidence when you take not just the body marks and the descriptions of the abductee, but the circumstances around it. And now with the Stan Romanek case that I mentioned earlier on, and you take and you add all of those pieces of evidence together, we keep saying here, people have been hung on less circumstantial evidence.
That's good. I wish I knew this case. I don't. And perhaps there's some reading I should do.
This case had only come to my attention in the last few weeks. And I've got the thing edited and it put it up at the website as real audio files. So perhaps if you'd care to at some point this week, go take a listen to that, because it's fascinating. And I know that there are all kinds of researchers who were involved in this case.
What you're describing is the kind of case that UFO investigators or abduction investigators can certainly get their teeth into, because if there are multiple witnesses, if they're independent witnesses who've viewed the same things from different locations mm-hmm. at roughly the same time, mm-hmm. if there are all these physical traces as well, you have what is beginning to put together as the kind of case that Bud Hopkins has, namely one with multiple sources of evidence, multiple phenomena that you can describe, and something a lot richer than one person's description. That's good.
Yes.
I'd love to see this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that the science of UFOs and abductions in the 21st century should be doing. And this is a really fascinating problem, because we collectively, the people interested in this stuff, have a lot of evidence about what's happening. The scientific community, in the narrow sense, looks at this evidence and says, we can't do that. There's no machine that we can make, our technology based on our science, that will do these things. Therefore, we'll ignore it or look for an easier explanation. Namely, they made it all up. Somebody went out there and scraped the ground. The magnetometer readings, well, maybe they weren't good at the instrument. They'll look for any possible semi-rational explanations to explain this stuff away, rather than taking the whole phenomenon as a picture and looking at its independent corroborative sources and seeing a phenomenon that exists but doesn't fit inside our science. And there's a great deal of scientific pride at stake here, because if you're admitting there's a phenomenon you can't understand, then you're admitting that your science doesn't know it all. And this is a big block, I think, for a lot of people in the professional scientific field. It's just something that people aren't willing to admit.
Yes.
Because it basically cuts the rug right out from under their, or our, since I'm a professional scientist too,
mm-hmm.
pretensions that we either know it all or are on our way to explain it all, you know, in the near future, if not right now.
Mm-hmm.
and it looks like somebody got there before us.
Well, we don't want to threaten our tenure by looking into it either.
Well, that would be dangerous if you don't have tenure. You're quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get research grants for that kind of stuff either. So there are some problems there for the academic.
Dr. Dondari, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight. The whole topic is fascinating, and you've added a really nice point of view as far as science is concerned. And I can assure you that your voice will end up as clips on this program for future use, because you said some really intriguing things, some interesting things, some quite nice explanations of why science isn't looking at it.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Good night, Dr.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Strange days indeed. UFO News Talk Radio on Montreal's CJAD 800 and 1010 CFRB in Toronto. We'll continue with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.